Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 13th of March. Afghanistan is what we talk about the first hour of our program today. And the latest update from BBC News is that Afghanistan militants attack Kandahar killing site. That's the headline. Militants in Afghanistan have launched an attack on a government delegation visiting the site where a U.S. soldier killed 16 civilians. Two of Afghan President Hamid Karzai's brothers and several top security officials were in the delegation. One Afghan soldier and three militants were killed, and the delegation is heading back to Kandahar. The U.S. soldier said to have carried out Sunday's attacks is under arrest. And of course, now we have this widespread conversation about what the mission is in Afghanistan and if the United States should pull troops out of the country before they were planning on doing so. This hour, we have a great guest with us. He's joined us many times before as we've looked at issues in Afghanistan. Thomas Goodyear, Dean of International Studies and Director of the Center for Afghanistan Studies at the University of Nebraska. He spent 10 years in Afghanistan. He served as a Peace Corps volunteer, a Fulbright Fellow, Executive Director of the Fulbright Foundation, and he also coached the Afghan National Basketball Team. He's testified on various topics related to Afghanistan, U.S.-Pakistani relations, international terrorism, and human rights. This before hearings of the U.S. Senate Foreign Relations Committee and the U.S. House of Representatives. And he is our guest this first hour of our program today. Our phone number, if you would like to join the conversation, and I would expect that many of you would, is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Professor Goodyear, nice to speak with you again. Thanks very much.
Kathleen, please call me Tom. it's nice to be back with you again, too. Thank you for that nice introduction.
Yeah, well, thanks for being with us, Tom. What do you make of all that's happened as a result of this horrible massacre over the weekend? Now, today, we're talking about whether or not we should withdraw troops, what our mission is. We're having a very serious conversation about what's going on in the country. Should we be?
Well, it's bound to be during a political season like we're going through right now in our own country. Something of this dramatic nature is going to stimulate such kind of dialogue. But I think it's important to point out that Secretary of Defense Panetta has been quick to say that this is not going to change our course or our focus or our strategies in the upcoming future relating to our overall plan for Afghanistan. And I think it was important for him and I think for the president to reiterate that. But I think it's, you know, understandable that when you have a series of events like have recently occurred in Afghanistan, all of a very kind of negative nature attributable to some of our actions, it's going to create those questions. I think more than anything else, the Afghans are concerned that those questions are being raised too, because most Afghans do not want to see us, cut and run in that country again as we have in the past.
Is that indeed what's going on the ground? Because the news reports indicate that there are a lot of Afghans who don't want us there anymore, including some of the security forces we're trying to train. So how do we know what the truth is?
Well, it's hard to tell when it's difficult to distinguish with whom you are dealing. And for many of our citizens, particularly our military, that is difficult because of the fact that they are not afforded the opportunity to get to know and interact with Afghans to the degree that might be most desirable. But I think that there's no question, and we have been in touch here from our center with people that we know in Kabul, including members of the Karzai government, and everyone to a person has indicated that their greatest concerns are that the United States and the international community will be leaving other than under the plan that has been discussed, because they're concerned after 40 years, really, of violence and volatility and war, in their country that without the presence of the international resources, both civilian and military, the opportunity to rebuild, reconstruct the institutions of Afghanistan, and also to have the security essential to doing that would be elusive. They just don't have the resources together to do that yet because of all the destruction that they've had to endure over the last several decades. So, I you know, you're going to see demonstrations, I'm sure. You're going to hear people making claims, particularly the Taliban. The Taliban do not speak for Afghans or the Afghan government. And you're going to hear people who, in their anger over these events, are going to speak out. But most Afghans, a vast majority of them, are very desirous of the continuing relationship between their country and the international forces there.
Do we, this is another story, but of course it relates to the actions of this sergeant. Do we need to take a look at maybe sending people into harm's way, into battle too often? We heard about brain injury that this sergeant had, 3 tours of duty in Iraq, first time in Afghanistan, the number of post-traumatic stress incidents that we're hearing about from soldiers who have been in these arenas. Is there something wrong with our policy here? Are we overextending our soldiers?
Well, you know, that's my reaction, but I'm not really qualified to be right. An analyst in that area. But, you know, my feeling is that anybody who's put in harm's way, as you mentioned it, Kathleen, needs to have all of the support, whether it's psychological or other health-oriented ways that need to be there for those persons. I think it's inconscionable not to be sending people into a war zone without that, and it doesn't sound like this individual received the right amount of counseling or help, perhaps. But again, that's only from what I hear, so it's based on hearsay information. I'm not informed enough yet to be making what I would call an authoritative statement on that, but I think they need the support.
The Defense Secretary, Leon Panetta, said that we are steadfast in our resolve to work hand-in-hand with our Afghan partners to accomplish the missions and goals on which we have been working together for so long. What are those missions and what are the goals? I think we're unclear about that in this country.
Well, I think we have been, and a large part of the reason for that is that we didn't have any clearly defined goals and objectives until really December of 2009. We went from year to year to year, and particularly after 2003, more focused on Iraq, and until December of 2009 when President Obama laid out a strategy. Not everybody agreed with it, but was a strategy with benchmarks. And I think the strategy, is clear that we're here to ensure that Al-Qaeda and any others of that nature are not able to, again, use Afghanistan for the purposes that brought the 9/11 events to us. And I think in that process, we've long understood that it's essential to help Afghans rebuild their institutions, help them restore the economy to a degree where the majority of the population is not jobless. Those are things that did exist in Afghanistan before the time of the Soviet invasion and the ensuing decades of destruction and war in Afghanistan. And unless there is that kind of stability, it's going to be virtually impossible to ensure that Afghanistan is not going to be vulnerable again to the interference of external, transnational, or border machinations. And I think it's very easy now for Americans to understand the degree to which Pakistan is able to be a real spoiler in Afghanistan, and we need to ensure that's not going to be the case, because it destabilizes Afghanistan. A destabilized Afghanistan is vulnerable again to hijacking by transnational organizations and others that want to use it for purposes that are inimical to our interests and to the interests of the Afghan people as well.
The other thing that has been said is with the death of bin Laden and the capture or killing of a number of top-level al-Qaeda, that al-Qaeda is simply not the force that it used to be, and so the possibility of a resurgent al-Qaeda in Afghanistan is pretty much off the table. What do you think?
Well, I hear that a lot, and in a sense, one answer is that al-Qaeda was never the force that it used to be because it's a very transitioning kind of movement. It was always very decentralized, and the whole kind of makeup of the syndicate itself or the movement itself was to establish franchises elsewhere. And so as we look at al-Qaeda today, it may not be what it was in Afghanistan at the time of 9/11, or maybe even in Pakistan. But when you look at Yemen, or you go to places, like the northern parts of Nigeria now, and the Horn of Africa, and other places, we see that al-Qaeda, has franchises there. So I think it continues to be a dangerous, movement or syndicate of franchises because it has chosen terrorism as its weapon, and weapon can very quickly destabilize and intimidate people, as well as to put economies and governmental processes in danger just by one major attack, as we've seen in not only the United States and what it did to us at 9/11, but also in England and in Spain and France and Indonesia, and what it's been doing to parts of the Horn of Africa. So it's still a very dangerous organization that has capacities well beyond a centralized type of movement that we, I think, tend to associate with most organizations because we think in centralizing terms and descriptions, but it is a very decentralized movement.
The other thing that keeps coming up, Tom, is the number of years that we have been there and the question being asked, why haven't we been able to make the country a more secure place over 10 years? It's a long time.
Mm-hmm. And I hear that question a lot as well. And there are several reasons. One primary reason, of course, is that we may have been there since, inside the country, really, since the very end of 2001. But we were focusing all of our efforts and strategies beginning in 2003 in Iraq. Most of the monies that had been allocated to fight the war on terror, as it was called, were allocated to go after those who attacked us. And they, of course, had come from training camps inside Afghanistan and to go after people like Osama bin Laden. We wound up under the Bush administration to use those monies, resources, and personnel. There were 150,000 plus American soldiers in Iraq at a time when we had only 25,000 in Afghanistan. And so we weren't really focusing on Afghanistan. Our policies there were languishing, and we were putting most of our effort into Iraq. And I think we tend to forget that. And so what we were doing in Afghanistan was marking time more than, marking progress in terms of the of set objectives, which we didn't have clearly defined. The other thing I think is so important to remember, Kathleen, is that we're still in Europe, some nearly 70 years after World War II. We're still in Korea after the Korean War, and in Japan after World War II. In other words, we have a presence in places where we believe our long-term interests and security are crucial. And I think we will need to recognize that in that part of the world in which Afghanistan is, we have a lot of interests, and Afghanistan will probably be a place where we will have some manner of presence, maybe similar to that which we have in Western Europe or South Korea or Japan. And then finally, you know, people say it's the longest war we've ever fought, but that's not true. The longest war we ever fought was the Cold War, and that went on from the late 1940s until the very early 1990s, so nearly 50 years of that. And we tend to forget that war, but that was a very serious one that could have annihilated us or our enemies. And but we remained steadfast in the commitment at that time, and I think we need to understand what these issues in places like Afghanistan, but not only there. You have a very volatile Pakistan next door, and in that region of petrochemical resources, both the Persian Gulf and the Caspian Basin, we have many interests that are very, very inextricably linked to our ability to function as a society as we have become.
And how do you factor in, I was alive during the Vietnam debate and era and saw how public opinion turned. Well, yeah, we saw how public opinion turned against that war, and as a result, the U.S. left. When you have two-thirds, it varies from 60% to two-thirds of the American public saying that they don't believe that the war in Afghanistan was worth fighting, what do you do with that? You just don't have much popular support for this.
No, and that's something that troubles me. I think part of it has to do, again, with something I mentioned earlier. This is the political season, and you're going to get comments like made by Newt Gingrich, which is I saw as a kind of a knee-jerk reaction to the events over the weekend. That'll happen, and that stimulates people's concerns. I think, quite frankly, that one of the things that is essential for President Obama to do, and which I don't feel he has done to the degree of his capability, because he's noted as a good speaker, able to present ideas forth so that people can understand them. He needs to do that again and again to help people understand what are the things that are at stake for us in a place like Afghanistan, and to make it understood that we're not there just because of narrow focuses relating just to Afghanistan, but there are other things that are a part of this that have to do with the stability and security of South Asia. India and Pakistan have always been at each other, and the issues in the Middle East that are part of a potential destabilization because of petrochemicals, etc. Our way of life is dependent on certain things. We're a global nation. We're not a parochialized, retracting nation. We have interests everywhere, and for our economy to continue to grow, after this recession, we need to be in a situation where we can move about the world with our commercial enterprises. And if the world's going to be beset by these conflicts, regional conflicts everywhere, that's not going to be possible. So it's important, I think, again, for our leaders to make those points understood. And I don't think there's been enough of that done. So I'm troubled by these statistics and things, as you suggest we might be.
We go to phone calls for our guests, and we'll take them in just a moment. Thomas Goodyear is our guest. He's an Afghanistan expert, Dean of International Studies, Director of the Center for Afghanistan Studies at the University of Nebraska, and perhaps even most importantly, he lived in the country starting as a Peace Corps volunteer. He was there for 10 years. He was also a Fulbright Fellow, Executive Director of the Fulbright Foundation, and coach of the Afghan National Basketball Team. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address, if you'd like to use that, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tomorrow during this hour, more primaries, Mississippi and Alabama today, and we will talk about those. Also during the first hour, there were several major news stories on voter ID, including in the state of Wisconsin. We will have the ACLU's director of the Voting Rights Project join us for part of this show to talk about the significance of those court decisions. Two phone calls. Victor in Milwaukee, good morning.
Good morning.
Hi.
Good morning to your guests.
Good morning.
I have a general question. I'm a member of the Armed Forces myself, and one of the things we become familiar with is when you're overseas, we're tenants, and you have status of forces agreements. And within those agreements, you know, if we commit a crime, regardless of it's minor or serious, in that host nation, we may be subject to their prosecution. And I'm wondering, over in Afghanistan, I'm not sure if you're familiar with it, does Sharia law come into mind on the status of forces agreements we have with Afghanistan? Because if they prosecute, they're going to want this man, and they want to prosecute him under their laws. So I'm wondering how much power does Afghanistan have in going through with this?
I think that's a very good question, and I have to confess that I don't know what are the component parts of our agreement along these lines, Victor, but you raise the issue of Sharia law. Afghanistan also does, by the way, have civil law, and I would imagine whatever agreement that we have with Afghanistan would be within the terms of civil law, defined within terms of civil law, and maybe even military law, as it would be between the military forces of both the United States or the international. The ISAF, or the International Forces, and the Afghan Forces. So I think we're going to learn a lot about that in the next week or so when the whole process of prosecution is going to emerge. And one can certainly understand the sensitivity of the Afghans, who may be demanding that they are participants, at least in this process, after those people have been killed in the way they were killed. Also, there will be elements, that will be concerned that this individual get due process of under military law codes that we have in our own system and our own legal processes. So, I don't have the answer because I don't know what the agreement is, but I'm confident that there is one, and it will be a very interesting. I think process, and I hope it's one that proceeds in a way that will not leave either side in a position of anger, because one can certainly understand the desire, I think, of Afghans to see that this person is prosecuted. It may be difficult if it proves to be true that this man was disturbed, for Afghans to understand that part of it, that'll make things even all the more complicated.
Thank you, Victor, very much for your call. Bud in Wausau, hi.
Good morning. Very interesting program. I wrote a letter to the editor about this very subject. About 9 months ago, I get Time Magazine. There was an article in the Time Magazine that depicted one of our military in Afghanistan standing next to one of the Afghan farmers at the poppy fields in the background. And it stated that the poppies represented 52% of the gross national product of Afghanistan. And when our military, it stated, are protecting these farmers' poppy fields, when the harvest comes, they sell it to our enemy, the poppies, for about $1 billion. That's transported then to Afghanistan, or to Pakistan, where it's refined into heroin, which is sold throughout Europe and North America for about $4 billion. That's the monies that our enemy uses for the the bombs and to finance the war against us there. And it's bringing heroin into our a party and a community 15 miles from us just died of an overdose. The interesting part of all this is that About a year ago, they announced that we're going to need to be there for four more years to train these Afghans before we dare to pull out. We've been there for 10 years. I don't know how many remember back, but in 1941, the Japanese attacked us in Pearl Harbor. Our country, along with our allies, tooled up. And in 4 years, we defeated the Nazis throughout Europe and North Africa and drove the Japanese out of the Pacific Islands that declared victory and went home. And we've been there for 10 years, and they need four more years to train these guys. What are we going to do different these next 4 years that we didn't do in the 10 years we've been there? I think the whole war is ridiculous. It's bankrupting our country, and it's causing misery, and it's time that war was over years ago.
Thank you, bud. Valid point, Tom.
Well, there are many, many points that he raises. Let me just quickly say one thing. We didn't declare victory and then pull up and go home after the Second World War. In fact, we're able to declare victory, but we're still there with our military forces in Germany and other bases in Europe, as well as in bases in Japan, and then subsequently in Korea. So it's always important to remember that. We tend to forget that part of it. The scenario that the caller reconstructed about the poppies in Afghanistan brings to my mind the fact that when I lived in Afghanistan, which you've described now a couple of times, Kathleen, I never saw a field under cultivation with opium poppies. It just wasn't a crop in Afghanistan. And currently it's still a very, very productive crop because, as the caller indicates, there are people who are eager to buy the products. And so Afghans who are still struggling to survive during a period of incredible instability in their history are using that. And so in some ways that we've been trying to protect the Afghan farmer and the Afghan family's ability to continue to transition from one type of economy to another. And Afghans have been moving away from the poppy growing into other things. The thing to remember about this region, which again the caller described the picture coming from, is that it used to be a primary fruit and nut exporting part of Afghanistan, very, very successful in that, producing pomegranates, grapes, raisins, other fruits and nuts that would go to the to South Asia, to the Persian Gulf. So Afghanistan has a history of being a successful nation in terms of production of other farm products. But after the years of war and destruction, reconstructing that segment of the Afghan economy is taking time. And to just immediately pull out the rug from all of the sources of income that the Afghan has would in some ways create more issues, more problems, because then you'd have the whole population in a region without any means for survival, and you're then would be driving them to the other side of the fight. So it's a much more complicated issue than a simple definition of a circumstance here and a circumstance there that can be changed in a day or even a short period of time. And then I already mentioned earlier, in response to, I think, a question you mentioned, Kathleen, about, you know, our period of time in Afghanistan, how long we've been there. And maybe the caller didn't hear that, but I stated that we came into Afghanistan, but then we got sidetracked and we were mostly in Iraq and kind of marking time in Afghanistan. So I think that we all understand that we're not going to have a success in Afghanistan unless we do it according to a strategy which now has been launched under President Obama and under Secretary of Defense, then Secretary of Defense Gates, and others in 2009. And I think, you know, we need to measure our future from that point.
Indications are, and tell me if these are erroneous, that we're having a pretty difficult time training Afghan forces, that it just doesn't seem to be working very well. Is that the case, and why is that the case?
It has been difficult to train Afghan forces, but I think almost everyone now who is involved in this has a sense that the process is moving along more favorably in recent years. You got to remember we were trying to rebuild a military that had not, from a set of circumstances which had seen no standing military other than occupying forces of the Soviet Union for decades. So Afghans we were having to train Afghans from the beginning, and I think the numbers have been growing much more rapidly than we anticipated, and I think the effectiveness of the Afghan forces that are oftentimes now the lead forces in regional military operations have proven to be of a higher degree than most people believed. We actually are involved a little bit in some of this. We're just in the process right now of training our 34th group of individuals who are serving as advisors, cultural advisors, to our military and our other elements of our government, intelligence and State Department, etc., here in Omaha. And I feel, as they do and others, that the process is moving along relatively favorably, that the initial efforts were, dismaying, but that has turned around. It's always going to be difficult in many ways because, again, it has to do with training people from different parts of a nation that is not a homogenized nation. But from our own experience, we know that America became more homogenized through our experience fighting together in the Second World War. People from different parts of our country, different races, etc., fighting in the same units. It had a lot to do with the expectations and policies that came out of the Second World War, including civil rights. And so it's a difficult process, particularly in a country where you have ethnic groups with different languages that have never really been homogenized much in their history.
We go next, Bud. Thanks for the call. Bill in Madison. Hi.
First, to correct the previous caller, the Axis powers in World War II, first Italy, then Germany, finally Japan, unconditionally surrendered. There was no walking away and declaring victory. There was them declaring defeat. The reason I called is to disagree with pretty much everything that your guest is saying for two reasons. One, there have been, when it comes to a war on terrorism, dating back way before 9/11 to, Libya, when Libya, Muammar Gaddafi in the 80s was sponsoring terrorism worldwide, we basically did surgical bombing, which, once he was convinced that the price for what he was doing was too high, his behavior stopped. We did not try to do any regime change. Now, in the case of Afghanistan, what we should have done was simply make the price for the Taliban government harboring and supporting al-Qaeda too high, not by going in a regime change. And the culture is too different. The idea of winning hearts and minds there is futile. I mean, the country, it's a very old country. They've been living the way they've been living for a lot longer than the United States has been here. And it's just, my second point is that the United States, by going around the world feeling like it has its interests in all these different places, and that therefore we have to have our military everywhere, like I understand we're in more countries than we're not, we're behaving more like an empire than we are like a responsible world power.
Tom.
Well, again, there are many points that this caller raises. I think I don't disagree with the idea that we need to pick our places where we go with our military, and I think we do now have technology, which we didn't have in the year 2001, that enables us to do these surgical strikes even more effectively with the drone weaponry systems that we have. And I think that we're learning a lot about that. Our defense policies and planning are being changed, reformed as a result of these particular resources. And I agree that we need to pick and choose where we can be most effective. I think the understanding of the caller and many people about what Afghanistan was is in grave error. I lived there in the 60s and 70s at a time when Afghanistan had a very stable constitutional monarchy, and it had had parliamentary elections. I witnessed two sets of those, 1965 and 1969. My wife is a Peace Corps volunteer, could hop on a bicycle and go biking all across the town, shopping and doing things all by herself without having to be concerned about her security. We could pick up on a weekend later on when we had the resources, when I was the executive director of Fulbright, and decide we're going to take a weekend's drive and long weekend vacation to Kandahar, where these events just occurred over the weekend without any concern about our security or safety. Afghan women constituted more than 50% of the employees in the government offices in Kabul, 60% of the teaching cadre of Afghanistan. So to say that Afghans have lived the same way their whole history is an error. That's not the case. What is the case, of course, is that once the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan, it destroyed the infrastructure of that country, and it forced a brain drain of the leadership and the intellectuals of Afghanistan as well. And I don't think that it's in any way against our interest to try and help the Afghans to restore themselves to that previous capacity, because we tend to forget something very important here. The Afghans were our allies in the last battle of the Cold War. The Soviet Union, the war of the Soviet Union in Afghanistan was the final straw upon the Soviet camel's back. It broke. Within 2 years after they retreated from Afghanistan, the Soviet Union imploded. And what we did right after the Soviet Union left is that we left as well, and we left the Afghans to the extremist forces in the area. I think we owe it to them to some degree to help them reconstruct. We did that in Europe. We did it in Japan. They were our enemies, the people that we helped to rebuild in Germany and Japan. The Afghans were our friends in that struggle. We didn't treat our friends as well as we did our enemies.
It's obvious the great fondness that you have for the country, and you were there for so long. You must have been heartsick by what happened to Afghanistan.
I have, and I'll tell you, Kathleen, it's difficult for me to go back, and I go back regularly. So many of the friends that I knew and interacted with there have been killed or have left the country to never return. The places that I used to frequent have been destroyed, not rebuilt. The basketball courts that I used to coach on, things of this nature. The thing that is still fun for me to go to return to is dealing with Afghans. And the Afghans are a unique people. I've never met a more hospitable people in my life. They're not hospitable to their enemies, but they are very hospitable to their friends. And I think that if you have a chance, if there are any callers who have a chance to call in and say they were serving in Afghanistan or either in the foreign service or in the military, they would echo that that sentiment. Afghans, very independent-minded people, very strong-minded people, but unparalleled in terms of their hospitality. And they also have a great sense of humor. They enjoy dancing and singing and living their lives the way people in the United States enjoy living their lives. And so that helps me to go back. But it is always a kind of difficult time, melancholy kind of experience, because I see so much destruction where previously we had enjoyed life so much. Our eldest son was born to us in Afghanistan. and lived the first 3 years of his life there without any concern. My wife could take him into the bazaars and shop, and people would just be admiring of the fact that, we had a child there. And so it was a very different time than it is now. And so when I hear things like the burning of the Quran and the death that caused us last weekend, the thing that causes me more grief than anything else is that I know that it's going to have it's going to color the impressions of us in the minds of some, at least for a short period of time. And you know, that's you know, very dispiriting, because I know Afghans feel that they don't have any good neighbors, and they've always considered Americans particularly, but also certain members of the international community, to be their best friends.
Tom Goodyear, our guest this hour. We're talking about Afghanistan this hour of the program. He's Dean of International Studies, Director of the Center for Afghanistan Studies at the University of Nebraska. He goes back to Afghanistan, as you heard him just say, frequently. He spent 10 years living in the country in a number of capacities, starting as a Peace Corps volunteer. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Our lines are filled right now, but there will be openings eventually. And our email, you can use that, talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program, Jim Fingal, fact-checker, co-author of The Lifespan of a Fact, which has been receiving a whole lot of attention, and it calls into question truth and accuracy. Those are big subjects. That's hour two. Tomorrow, we will be looking at the primaries in Mississippi and Alabama, and we will also, because of the number of decisions concerning voter ID, be speaking about that with the director of the Voting Rights Project for the ACLU, who's going to be the keynote speaker at the ACLU banquet this weekend. So he'll be joining us by phone from Atlanta for part of tomorrow's first hour. Back to phone calls. We go to Rick in La Crosse. Hi.
I'm just appalled at the fact that the gentleman doesn't understand that is their country, and they have home court advantage, and they're always going to win. And it doesn't help when you pee on corpses and you burn them, and that's their country. When is the U.S. going to stop invading other countries and going into, you know, I'm glad that I never naturalized, because, hey, I can travel anywhere the world over. Nobody wants to kill me. I'm actually from a South American country, very famous for soccer, and all they think of when I show my passport is soccer. They don't think, oh, imperialist. You know, and that's, you know, this is what I want to say, you know, when are we going to learn not to, when is the U.S. going to learn not to go and invade other countries and try?
All right, we got the question. Tom.
Well, I think, you know, in the case of Afghanistan, the United States experienced the 9/11 attacks by people who were trained, not Afghans, but were trained in Afghanistan by people who had gone in and already and occupied, in many ways, or at least hijacked Afghanistan, the members of Al-Qaeda, the Pakistani military and intelligence. And so I think we had to go after those folks. They were attacking our interests and killed our citizens. I don't consider that imperialist invasion. History will have some interesting debates, however, I think, with our actions in Iraq. And there are some who feel that that was not the right place or right time or right type of action during that time. There are others who think that it was. So history will have to decide on that. But I don't think that the United States is the type of nation that is going around indiscriminately invading and occupying countries around the world. In fact, the United States has always been very hospitable to people like the recent caller who have chosen to make their lives here in the United States. And I think that's another important characterization that we must all remember about what the United States does around the world.
What do you make, though, of Rick's comments concerning other incidents that have taken place? And the other question that I had regarding that is, we've made a lot of those in the press here, and certainly this murder over the weekend was absolutely horrendous. How do you, in the process of a village stabilization program, make sure that you're reassuring the people in those villages, and you've lived there and worked there, that this was just an aberration when it comes on the heels of burning the Quran and desecrating bodies? How do you do that?
Well, it's something that you don't do in the short term. It's something that's going to require a long-term effort, Kathleen. And, you know, I hope that soon our ambassador goes to that village, that region in Panjwayi of Kandahar province in Afghanistan, to apologize to those families. And I hope that quickly we provide the reparations that I think are generally provided to people who are experiencing the loss of such family members. And I think we're going to have to count on our long-term record, track record in Afghanistan, which has been checkered at times, but which has been won over nearly a half century of some very, very high successes with Afghans. The 1950s, we helped the Afghans provide the rural electrification and the stabilization of their agricultural economy. We did that with other nations that were in Afghanistan, so we weren't just there, as suggested by one of the previous callers, in an imperialistic way. We were providing economic and developmental assistance. We did a lot of that in the areas of education. I was able to participate in that as a Peace Corps volunteer and later on as a head of the Fulbright Foundation, where we changed Kabul University from an institution that was not very of high quality to one which became recognized throughout all of that part of Asia as among the best, in which its engineering, agriculture, and education courses were taught all in English. During the 1980s, the United States stood with the Afghans after the Soviet Union invaded that country. We didn't invade it. The Soviets did, and we help the Afghans regain their independence. We've been trying to help Afghanistan rebuild its institutions since the 9/11 period. Afghans remember those things as well, and so these other unfortunate incidents tend to derail or at least impede the progress or the advantages that come to the Afghans from our efforts. And unfortunately, they sometimes color the rest of those involved in doing good just by association with those who have made a mistake or have committed a crime. But in the long run, I think Afghans have the capacity to forgive. People ask me that. They say Afghans have long memories. Will they ever forgive us? Afghans don't forgive their enemies, but they do forgive their friends, and they understand what our long-term role has been in that country, which has been a constructive one, not one in which the Soviets, and previously, by the way, the British Empire three times invaded the country and tried to occupy parts or all of the country. We haven't tried to do that.
Ellen in Milwaukee, we have about a minute left. Hi, Ellen.
Hi there. I'm 70 years old, and I've been around a while, and it seems like my whole life has been with us in some war zone. And it seems to me like if somebody were to attack our country, we wouldn't want them hanging around a long time. We've never had to endure this kind of thing, and I don't think many of us often think about what all these countries have gone through and are going through, and it just seems horrible to have a country ripped apart the way some of these countries have been.
We have about 30 seconds, Tom.
Well, I agree, and Afghanistan certainly has been ripped apart. It's the worst period in its history, the last 40 years, certainly different than that one which I described earlier. And actually, we have been attacked, Pearl Harbor and that event, they brought a Second World War on us, and then 9/11. And so we've had to deal with that. But I agree with the caller. You know, the Afghans, the lives of the Afghans have been very, very difficult because of the last 40 years. And I appreciate her heart going out to them and the others that have gone through the same kinds of things.
Thank you, Tom, so much for being with us.
Great to be with you, and it's nice to learn that you and I may have experienced parts of the 60s together.
Yeah, well, it was quite a time. Tom Goodyear, our guest this hour, Dean of International Studies, Director of the Center for Afghanistan Studies at the University of Nebraska. I always like to say that he is a master baker, too. He received his certificate at the age of 18 and lived in Afghanistan for 10 years. Coached the Afghan national basketball team. We thank him for his time, and thanks for all of your calls, everybody. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour, and to Rhonda as well for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. We'll have news coming up, and we'll return.